Welcome to Compliance Perspectives. I'm your host, Courtney Nordrum, from the Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics. I'm live in Prague on-site at SCCE's European Compliance and Ethics Institute. And today I'm talking with Odell Guyton. Odell was one of our co-founders and has been in compliance since before they called it compliance. Welcome to the podcast, Odell.
Thank you, Courtney. How are you this morning?
I'm great. We are both sitting here with our coffee. It's bright and early, 9 a.m. And I was just telling Odell that he is one of the few people that can remember when compliance wasn't even called compliance. So can you tell us kind of how you got started in what we now call compliance?
Compliance? Wow. Yeah, man, many years ago, I started out as a bounty hunter.
Really?
Yes, I did.
That's crazy. Okay.
I would chase bail skips all over the eastern U.S. and bring them back to court to face charges after they've skipped bail. So that was my first entree into, a small aspect of the criminal justice system. And of course, when I graduated college, I went to law school, American University, and upon graduation from law school, I was hired by Ed Rendell, the then district attorney, who later became governor of Pennsylvania. And so there, I rose through the ranks to the rank of deputy DA and was offered a job at the U.S. Attorney's Office. So getting back to the question of when I started in compliance, it really was as a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Okay.
And as you may recall, or may not, the sentencing guidelines at that time had just come into play around November of 88, so. And then there was talk about corporate guidelines, which came in later in 92. Mm-hmm. But at that time, guidelines were just a commentary in the sentencing guidelines. It's like just a small little...
Asterisk.
Yeah, asterisk. And so not many people knew about it. But in terms of being a prosecutor, when you had a conviction, you had to go through the guidelines and help the judge determine what type of offense score and then prior record score would equate to the sentence. And at that time, the guidelines were mandatory, so a judge had to impose it or the government could appeal the sentence. Since then, those appeal rights have gone away and it's more discretionary on the judge. But the idea was to have uniform sentencing. And so when I left the U.S. Attorney's Office and I became more involved in the defense, the white-collar criminal defense, several of our clients were major corporations that were now targets of federal investigation. And of course, you know, in doing the internal investigations for those companies, we would counsel our clients, had you had a compliance program in place, you would not be facing these issues now.
Or it would be significantly less in fines.
Well, they wouldn't have been facing them.
Really?
Yeah, because it was more, guidelines are really more preventative in terms of their application than retroactive in terms of reducing sentence. Yes, if you really could show that you had an effective program, you would not be charged, but that was always discretionary with the prosecutor. But had you had the program in place, on a preventative level, you would have caught the issues and then corrected them before they became issues that now are in front
of the government's attention.
Exactly. So that was the counsel that we gave our clients. Some of them took it to heart. Others didn't, like any kind of legal advice you give a client. But that was my initial start into compliance. And then as myself and the firm became known for implementing compliance programs, that kind of spread through certain industries and allowed us to really get a foothold in an early stage where many general counsel at the time just didn't believe in compliance programs. They thought it was unnecessary.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, that would be the pushback. We'd say, well, why didn't you counsel your client, you know, talking to the in-house general counsels about putting in a compliance program? Well, I didn't think that was necessary or that type of thing. So now, of course, things have changed. Clearly, since Sarbanes-Oxley came into play in 2002, mandating compliance programs in publicly traded companies,
you
have a different attitude now.
So. They're singing a different song.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's go back to when the corporate guidelines were enacted, 25 or so years ago.
The individual guidelines preceded the
starting in 92 and looking forward, what has been your experience with the challenges in moving compliance forward?
Well, the biggest thing that I see, having been a practitioner, not only on the prosecutor side and then the defense side, but now in-house, is understanding or creating a balance between corporate resources enabled to make the program or enable the program to be effective and the business operations, right? So mm-hmm. compliance is a cost center, right? It doesn't necessarily generate income for the company, and a lot of the skill of a compliance officer is one of those persons who can persuade their business colleagues to understand that they're the ones that actually own compliance. And it really isn't a heavy lift if in planning their business and moving the business forward, they include compliance considerations in how they do business. So not trying to minimize all risk, but to manage risk relative to the type of business they're in, the region that they're in, and knowing what they're likely to encounter in doing the business of the company in those regions. If you kind of shift their mindset to that versus compliance as an afterthought, mm-hmm. then compliance really becomes more effective business planning than anything else, right? And so what you do as a compliance officer in developing your program, you're really trying to build a defensible case for the company in terms of if there is an issue that comes up, you can negate any type of criminal intent so that you make a more persuasive case to a skeptical regulator that the intent of the action was not to be a criminal violation. So that's the type of thing that is really the challenge internally from a compliance perspective, is persuading your business partners who are creating the risk that they're responsible for the risk.
Yeah.
Now, when the compliance department becomes a dumping ground or becomes the excuse why you can't do something, that's when compliance is not effective.
Have you seen a shift over the last 30 years in thinking of compliance as the police who are there to tell you what you can't do versus what we hope compliance is now? It's someone who tells you how to prevent problems on the front end.
Right. Well, of course there's a shift because people don't understand what compliance is. Mm-hmm. The fact that we are in Prague today discussing compliance is a huge shift.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Because compliance in Europe was non-existent. We'd always hear, nobody understands what compliance is. We don't have a word for that in our language. We don't have a word for that in our culture.
Wow.
And so now that you now have a compliance conference here in the EU and here in Prague, I mean, that's just an incredible marker right there. But the point is, even in the U.S., you still have the same types of things. So yes, there's been a shift. And I don't want to put it on the fact that there's more enforcement. I want to say that hopefully better business planning has kind of created the need. When you see companies like Walmart and their investigation and now their board literally changing where the reporting of compliance should be, that is a major shift.
Huge.
Yeah, huge shift. But, you know, there's also stuff that the government can do. The government can give us more examples of why it is beneficial to have a program. Cite more examples where when you have a good program, the government does give you leniency or decides not to prosecute.
And the DOJ did just issue a document that has made the compliance world very happy.
Yeah, But that's just a document. I don't want to be critical. I mean, where's the action?
Where's
the reward?
Yes.
And the other thing is, of course, they've also put more emphasis on individual conduct and make sure that anyone that was involved in the activity gets outed before you can even get to cooperation. Mm-hmm. So these are things that were quite different. Even the SEC enforcement arm has become a lot more of a player in the exercise of compliance enforcement. And you have other entities, particularly on the healthcare side, the OIG, with its guidance, they've been very upfront and out front with the types of things that they try to encourage compliance in the healthcare arena. So yeah, there's been a huge shift. It's undeniable.
You mentioned individuals.
Yes.
So we've seen a shift recently, and the Yates memo definitely spoke to liability for compliance or for people who ignored compliance issues. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Well, it's always been the practice of the U.S. government, you know, to focus on the individual first, and if their conduct is such that it now brings in the liability to the corporation, then charge the corporation. The Yates memo adds nothing new to traditional federal law enforcement, but what it does add is it says, before you can get the benefits of a compliance program, before you can get the benefit of having good practices, if there are individuals in the company that the company has not provided enough evidence to prosecute them, That's kind of the trigger. So it puts the pressure on the company to now hand over the head of the people that were accountable for the and see, the government has this theory of gatekeeper prosecution.
Okay.
So if you, by your title or your position, were in a position to stop the behavior that they're now investigating, and you fail to close that gate, you fail to stop it, it's kind of like a negligence aspect or intentional. They're saying that the reason that you failed to stop it because it's intentional, because you wanted to benefit from the
improper. Because you were making money, shareholders
exactly.
were making money.
And that's what a corporation is there for, right? To make money. So anyway, so the Yates memo just says, before you can get the benefits of a compliance program or reduce sentence or reduce fine, you now have to hand over the individual that should have been the one to close that gate.
So we're sitting here in Prague,
yes,
a lovely
a beautiful day. It's raining.
Yesterday was gorgeous. It was sunny and 70 degrees.
Yeah.
And you were mentioned earlier how when you started, Europe had nothing. And the U.S. was just kind of evolving into compliance. And now every year we're seeing more European countries enact legislation. So Spain has legislation, Italy has legislation requiring compliance programs, and France just passed the Loi Sapin 2. I don't speak French, please don't kill me for murdering that, requiring compliance programs. So it seems to be evolving quite quickly here in Europe. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think you have to kind of, if you really want to get into an analysis of it, an anatomy of the kind of change, it's, let's take France for example. Before, at the time of Sarbanes-Oxley, right, there was a huge push in the United States for compliance for companies, and of course the hotline and all these components. Well, France is, to some extent today, totally against hotlines, right? So the restriction was, or the accommodation that they made was, you could have a hotline if the hotline only dealt with reporting financial matters.
Okay.
But any other things were...
Doesn't count.
You can't have... And you had to go through the CNIL and get approved and all these other things and the works councils and everything like that. I think that's still in play. So the new laws coming out really are focused on compliance within the anti-corruption and bribery realm.
Yes.
That seems to be the focus. And when you look at how they're structured with the countries that, some of which you named, they usually tailor the law that applies from their colonial predecessor, right? So, you know, so in England or United Kingdom, they have the anti-bribery law.
Yes.
And a number of countries are picking up from that colonial experience. And so the French colonies, they kind of pull back on the French. But I think the largest growth outside of anti-corruption bribery is in the privacy area. So it's this post-Snowden impact on privacy, which has always been a big deal in Europe.
Oh, huge.
A huge deal. And so it's now even a huger deal.
The GDPR coming into effect.
Exactly. Now, the interesting thing is there's going to be a tension for U.S. companies, particularly in the privacy aspects, because some of these laws require the privacy officer to, by law, be a whistleblower against the company directly to the government.
Yes.
Okay, and these are criminal acts for not disclosing problems in your company related to privacy. So from a U.S. perspective, it does create a number of different things practically from a compliance management standpoint. Well, how do you do an investigation in Europe now? Mm-hmm. How do you obtain information without having to disclose to the subject that you're obtaining information? You see,
the logistics
are going to be horrendous, right? Yeah. And even in China, you know, when you do investigations in China, I've always been told that it's against Chinese law for a non-Chinese person to investigate a Chinese citizen. So you have that's a challenge, right? So you have all these types of hurdles to get through. And the danger that I see from compliance professionals is getting it wrong, mm-hmm. not having proper procedures to deal with it before it happens, okay? And then not documenting properly. But even with the documentation, the transportation of information out of one country to another can also create issues. So where was that record created? Where is it located now? How can you get it out of that country back to the U.S.? We would violate that sovereign's law. So there's all kinds of complications in this compliance field that were not present when I first started some over 30 some odd years ago.
Back in the day, it was get everyone to follow the rules. And
exactly.
Now it's how do we get everyone to follow the rules when all of the rules are different?
Exactly. And how can I do my job?
Yes. So looking back on your entire career and the changes that have come and the progress that's been made in compliance, what do you see coming up in the future for the compliance profession?
Well, I think for the compliance professional, let's start there first. Mm-hmm. I think the challenge is going to be whether or not companies continue to substantially resource the compliance function or treat it more as a necessary evil that is there, that mm-hmm. they can say that they have it, and not really provide the tools or provide personnel, qualified personnel to get through it. Okay, that's one thing that I fear. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I fear is that more and more compliance officers may become targets themselves.
Okay.
Either because they did not know about certain things, or that they did know and the company did not take the proper steps to address it.
Okay. Yep.
A key example of that is the Volkswagen mm-hmm. matter, since we're in Europe.
Yes.
And where the government, our U.S. government, determined that the compliance officer was complicit in the cover-up, in the non-disclosure, in the decisions mm-hmm. not to disclose the issues relative to clean
diesel. The
evidence
points that he knew.
Yeah, well, not only did he know, but he apparently, in discussions with the government, with the prosecutors, was not forthcoming with the number of things that they later found out through letters and memos that he actually
That is not a best practice.
Not a best practice at all. So I think one of the tensions you're going to have is, getting back to the whether you're a corporate cop or mm-hmm. whether you are there to protect the shareholders, I think finding our role in this vastly changing environment, I think it will behoove a compliance professional to always stay on top of not only the what's happening in their industries, but what's happening in the profession, as well as reaching outside their comfort zone, mm-hmm. understanding where the company is going, become better partners with the financial people in your company, you know, understanding what the public filings are saying about where the company is going, what money was spent, where they invested in their time, so that you become relevant in the discussion about the future of the company and have influence with the officers, other officers within the corporation, so that they become your partners as opposed to now telling you what's wrong after it's occurring. So I think that's the challenge that we have faced.
Well, Odell, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule here at the ECEI to meet with me and talk about compliance.
Well, as you said in the beginning, I'm one of the co-founders. This was my idea. I hope it hasn't turned into a nightmare for the staff.
No, but it's fantastic. It's great.
But I really do appreciate the work of the SECE staff and all the personnel involved with the HCCA, and because our mission is to be there for the professional and help the profession move along. So in the next 30 years, you'll have someone else in this seat asking them questions about where we're going.
I'll be retired by that point, hopefully. But thank you. I really appreciate
it,
Odell.
All right.